Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. I have Nina with me today. Hello, sister in Brooklyn.
Hello, sister in London. So today we have as our guest Christopher Guyver, who has written a book in about 2016 on the Second French Republic, and that was a political reinterpretation. But he's here today to talk to us about a new project, which is his work on Leopold I of Belgium. And we should probably immediately reassure the audience that this is Uncle Leopold, if you've been watching any series on Victoria and Albert. Not bad Leopold
the Not second. Bastard Leopold, who right, runs around exactly. the Congo treating it as right. his own private fiefdom and having it, people exactly. lock hands off and stuff.
You've got
it. May
it.
Come up later, but that's not why we're here, is it, Christopher?
Right.
No.
So, Christopher, can you start by telling us a little bit about, I mean, we've, many of us, if we've read a little bit about Leopold I, but I must say that I know my introduction, embarrassingly, was coming to grips with him as he was depicted on assorted programs about Queen Victoria as yes. her yeah. uncle and so can you tell us more about Leopold, his early life, you know, where he's yeah. from and so on?
Well, there's a lot. I think, first of all, him being the uncle of Victoria is important.
Okay.
That is quite a big story. So it's fair enough. I mean, to refer to him as Uncle Leopold. Now he's somebody who has a very much a sort of cosmopolitan career and upbringing. He's first of all the German prince, son of a duke. He becomes a British prince and ends up king of the Belgians. So that's three nationalities. He's a Russian general.
He's a Coburg as well, isn't he?
Yes.
He's Albert's family.
He is born in Saxe-Coburg-Saalfeld, in the town of Coburg, on the 16th of December, 1790.
Yeah, so he has a foot in both camps, doesn't he? Because he's closely related to Albert, because Albert yes. and Victoria are yes. cousins, aren't they? So
he is, yes. His oldest brother, Ernest, whose birthday it was yesterday, was Albert's father. And his oldest sister, Victoria, was Victoria's mother. And it's via his sister that the name Victoria is introduced into the British royal family. It's also introduced into British culture by Victoria. You don't get many Victorias born before 1819. Also, Leopold is connected with the Romanov dynasty in Russia, as his older sister, Julia, or Yulchen, whatever, married Grand Duke Constantine in 1895. Except, big upon, 1795. I made that mistake the other day. There's also, I mean, Helen Rappaport's writing a biography of her, which should be published, I think, early this year. So the Coburgs are very much connected already to some of the leading families in Europe, especially the Romanovs. And Leopold's great uncle was a field marshal who, but the, and this I think has a great impact both on Victoria and Albert as well, and possibly on Nasty Leopold II, is that before Leopold's birth, the Duchy of Saxe-Coburg went bankrupt. And it's this very small area. I mean, sneery British historians like to say, oh, it's the same size as the Isle of Wight. I mean, one actually might be slightly more original and say it's the same size as Rutland. It's a small area. Now, so what? Well, part of me thinks, so what? The Habsburgs came from a small area originally, Habsburg, which is now Switzerland. You know, the Hohenzollerns started off as burghers of Nuremberg, and also, you know, so Prussia began as a small area too, Brandenburg. So there's a slightly sort of sneery attitude that often British historians make about Coburg. I mean, but this goes right back to Thackeray. You know, he liked to satirize Coburg as the pumpernickel state, so a sort of chitty chitty bang bang world of sort of.
They feel like the slipper and the rose as well.
Yeah. It's a sort of fairy tale. It's a sort of rather naff, sort of tinselly fairy tale Disneyland, but about the same size as Disneyland as well. So it's really. So there's a little bit of a sort of inferiority complex, perhaps, but also a great sense of dynastic entitlement.
There's huge ambition as well with Leopold, isn't there?
Definitely. And I think, I mean, I say this as an eldest brother, so I don't quite have the insight here, but Leopold's very much a younger brother. So you have a sort of very large family. He's sort of piggybacking already. You know, he's People within sort of the dynasties of Europe know of him already. For example, Tsar Alexander, Russia, enrolls him in the Russian army. One day after Leopold's birth, the Holy Roman Emperor, Leopold II, is actually present in Coburg and sort of becomes his godfather. So we have this quite interesting tension between something which is very much a small state and it's a dynastic network. And I think Leopold and dynasticism cannot be separated. And of course, the interesting thing is he's born in 1790, so that's 15 months and 2 days after the fall of the Bastille.
Ah, interesting.
And one thing he's always doing, though, he's always saying that he always seems to confuse the dates. He always seems to think the French Revolution broke out in 1790, which is almost a solipsistic, where so, you know, everything changed when I was born.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, I suppose we all think that, but...
Interesting.
But you had this, he's very much aware that he is an endangered species of royalty. And indeed, his early years are spent very much impoverished. Well, I mean, when I say impoverished, that's very much a relative term.
Yeah.
You know, he's brought up in a house. He was born in a house rather than the palace. Which I think a lot of impoverished people in the 1790s may not think that was particularly impoverished. But by his teenage years, of course, the war has broken out with France, starting right way back in 1792 when he was two, but only really comes to have immediate impact on him after the Battle of Austerlitz, when the French troops actually occupy Coburg. And his older brother, Ernest, goes to join the Russian army. And this comes quite interesting. This is when when Leopold is actually sent over to Paris almost as a hostage under the tutelage of Napoleon. Now, this is where things get quite interesting. Now, I mean, Napoleon had an eye. He quite liked handsome young men. I'm not going to go any further with that.
Yeah.
But he certainly, he's also possibly cynical enough to know that, you know, good-looking young men enhance one's, gives him glamour points.
Right. Especially if you're not one.
Yeah. Yes. He describes him much later on, and I think he was stirring, actually. I mean, might come back to this later. When Napoleon got married to Charlotte, he said to Lascaz, Napoleon on St. Helena, said, "Oh, yes, you know, Leopold is the most beautiful creature in the Tuileries Palace," which is, and then Napoleon adds, "Well, you know, he did ask me to be his ADC, if he could be his ADC." Now, Napoleon must have known that would get back to Britain.
Yeah,
definitely.
And really, you know, could be damaging. In fact, it was that Napoleon asked Leopold to be his ADC. But I mean, Napoleon lying is not exactly, you know.
Not a spoiler, is it?
Napoleon was, I mean, I don't want to go off on a bony tangent, but Napoleon was very much a master politician.
Absolutely. And so how does Leopold get himself untangled then from Napoleon and France while his brother is fighting with the Russian army?
The answer is the Treaty of Tilsit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Ernest now, so that's all cool in the sense that Napoleon... Ernest can now come to Paris too. They're taken under the wing of by Napoleon's wife, Josephine.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a lot of history books say very knowingly, oh, yes, well, Leopold had an affair with Josephine's daughter, Hortense. And Hortense at the time was Queen of Holland, quite unhappy with her husband, King Lucien. I think it's while it's tempting to think that the future King of the Belgians had an affair with the Queen of Holland, I think it's actually... I don't think it's possible. For one thing, we know that he fancied Hortense's lady-in-waiting, Louise Gauchelet.
Hmm.
And I think he was quite young, and I don't know, maybe stretching it a little bit to see Hortense as a sort of Mrs. Robinson. Cougar. I mean, it's not, I mean, of course, he was a young man.
Yeah.
You know, adolescent, away from his mother, you know, maybe, you know, it's not beyond, we don't know, he may well have sown his wild oats there. But this is, again, one thing that history books like to repeat. You know, he definitely had an affair with Hortense.
Mm.
He didn't. But, well, I don't think he did. There's no evidence. Call me Mr. Boring, but I'd like to have a little bit of...
Nobody wants your facts and logic, Christopher.
Absolutely not, no.
But in terms of what he is going to do, we've already mentioned his dynastic ambition.
Yes.
He's nearly... King consort of Britain before Albert, isn't he?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, one of the things that the Napoleonic Wars does, in a way, is bring dynasticism again to the forefront, because Napoleon's very keen on marrying people. Once Napoleon's defeated in 1814, first time round, Leopold goes over Channel with Tsar Alexander to visit England. And now... It's possible, no, so again, it's possible. I mean, he did have his eye partly on the main prize, which is, of course, the heir to the throne, Charlotte.
Charlotte, right, Princess Charlotte.
Who is the daughter of the Prince Regent. She's the only daughter. Her parents are very much estranged. She managed to do it once.
She is the future of the monarchy.
She's the future of the monarchy. And it is planned that she marries the Prince of Orange, and she's not keen on that, partly because she doesn't want to leave this country. And think one thing the regent liked to do was send people abroad to get rid of them, which is probably slightly nicer than throwing them out of windows. But there's always a sort of plot and idea to sort of send people over to Hanover just to get rid of them. But Charlotte rather slowly falls in love with Leopold, and Leopold at this time is very much a sort of, again, I suppose it's part of literature. You know, he's very much a sort of admirer of beautiful women. He's, you know, he tends to be very, very cool, very, very sort of, we would call it creepy, but it's very, very sort of courtly way. He gets a bit of a reputation for this. But it takes Charlotte about, once Leopold has left the country, gone back to Coburg, Charlotte then decides he's the one. And anyway, he comes. This is when I start to really pick up the trail, because I've been reading her letters to him. I rediscovered in the 1990s.
Wow!
And she's got the worst handwriting ever. And believe me,
I feel like our friend Carolyn will challenge you. Yeah. And say, have you met Princess Amelia?
Well, she's up. Well, she's up very much in the top. No, she's a contender.
Yeah. No, Queen Alexandra, where everything looks like a magic eye picture.
Yep. Yeah. Unfortunately, they don't all write like George V or George VI.
Absolutely.
I mean, Leopold's writing is actually quite clear, but Charlotte then writes in this sort of very, in this scrawl, infantile French, because Leopold can't speak English.
Of course not. So yes. French is their common language. Yes. She writes
and at the moment, I'm sort of going through it, and it's sort of, It's pretty hard work. Because the thing is, Leopold crosses the channel in 1816 to meet his betrothed. The regent decides, and his mother, Princess Charlotte, decides, what's the best precedent for this? And they go back to the early 18th century and discover that when last time a fiancé came over the channel, he and the two betrothed had to stay apart until the marriage under sort of chaperoned lockdown.
Interesting.
Which is great for me because I can read the letters.
Right.
But I think they are pretty much desperate for it, you know. But you get sort of daily letters of neediness from Charlotte's side. I'm sure Leopold's also got a very bad toothache. We can discuss his health a bit later. But I mean, by the time they get married, 2nd of May, 1816, he becomes very popular. I mean, I think this is partly when you start to get Coburg places and Coburg all over this country. You tend to get sort of the pub, right, the Royal Coburg, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So this does make him a bit of a megastar.
Interesting. Yeah.
And these are the sort of, this is the golden, these are, they become a sort of golden couple. You know, I don't need to make any comparison, as it were, between modern, you know, it happens every single time in this country, right, anyway. The royal family gets married, you get sort of, so this time it's Leopold and Charlotte mania.
Interesting, yeah.
Now, of course, I think they actually become a little bit sort of smugged married. There is, they're very, very sort of, I'm very happy.
Yeah.
Very happy for them. I mean, Charlotte is very unhappy. Leopold is a bit of a sort of, was very much a wanderer. He didn't really have a basis. As a younger son, even of a sort of princely family, you usually are a bit sort of, you have to find your role.
Right.
And, I mean, for example, the Old Vic was meant to be opened, the theatre in West London was meant to be opened by them, but they decided they couldn't turn up and do it. So an alderman had to do it. Which was a spoilt the day for everybody but him, because it's his name on the foundation stone.
Instead of theirs, yeah.
Charlotte friend dumps close friend called Mary Elphinstone, Mercer Elphinstone. So there's a little bit of sort of, again, sort of smug married activity in that respect. Mm-hmm. She suffers one miscarriage, which makes everybody sad. Now, and then she decides to, when she's pregnant again, she asks a gentleman called Sir James Croft to be her male midwife.
Mm.
Now, this was possibly the worst decision she ever made in her life.
Oh dear.
Because having a royal doctor was more or less a sort of trying to commit suicide, I think. Mm. You're going to get, and the crowning tragedy is at Claremont House in Surrey on the 5th, at 9 o'clock in the evening on 5th of November, 1817. Her baby is born dead, stillborn. It
happens. Yeah,
you can get another one. Unfortunately, the Sir James Croft, the male midwife, thought it was a good idea that women sort of before childbirth should be starved.
Oh God!
So he decided the best thing was to don't give her any food, starve her, and then of course, 5.5 hours after the stillbirth, Charlotte herself dies.
Mm.
Leopold was asleep at the time. I mean, the labour had lasted 50 hours.
Oh, God.
Again, without chloroform. Later on. Mm. And everything has gone.
Yeah.
All his hopes. He was possibly going to be, he could have been, as Alex said, he could have been prince consort or even queen consort. The title wasn't confirmed. Right. He could have had a sort of role for himself. Instead, this is rather sort of Byronic thing. You know, he's only 20, he's nearly 27, which is quite a lot younger than I am. You know, it's quite a lot. He's just, everything just evaporated.
Right, right. With the death of Charlotte, he no longer has a role. Yeah. He's the youngest son. And so,
yeah.
What is he going to do next? I knew that she had died after a miscarriage. I didn't realize the circumstances were so horrific.
Yes. There's a tragic coda to that, because Sir James Croft, was rather upset about it. You know, a few months later, he was present at another high society birth, and it was exactly the same symptoms.
Oh dear! Yeah.
So he decided to go into another room and shoot himself.
Mm, gosh.
She did, which would not have been much help to the mother.
Not really, no. Mm-mm.
And I mean, Leopold just thought he was a bloody fool. I mean, he was very much at the mercy of, I mean, as all royalty was, very much at the mercy of royal doctors who are more like courtiers.
Right.
Really,
right.
Than members of the medical profession.
Yeah.
Comes to the period which I think is one of the most difficult bits for me to research of Leopold's life, the sort of between Charlotte and his sort of and the late 1820s. He's basically a sort of youngish man with a huge grant from £50,000 from Parliament a year.
Mm.
And all he can do, also, what he does is basically travel the continent.
I was going to say, how sorry does he feel for himself? I mean, the money would help.
Incredibly sorry.
Yeah.
He's very good at self-pity.
Because it's like, yeah, you've got 50,000 a year, which is a hell of a lot of money at the time. Yeah, but you were going to be King of England.
Yeah. Well, I think also, I mean, I think it's a slight sense of, well, this was my due anyway. And I've got the large house in Surrey, in Claremont. I've got, you know, all the positions. I mean, he asked the regent to make him a royal highness, and the regent does that.
If that's Claremont School now, I played netball against them.
Yes, I went. I had a look around there in 2019.
Is it the school?
It is. Yes, it's Fancourt School, which is a Christian scientist school. So it belongs to the royal family up until the early 1920s.
Interesting.
But it's, you can still see the room where Charlotte died. It's a classroom, but it's been kept pretty much.
Gosh.
As it is. So it does give one a sense. And, I mean, it is also, I mean, I could go, I mean, I did ask, I was a bit disappointed. I said, are there any ghost stories? You know, you'd have thought being a boarding school as well, there'd be ghost stories. But no. So
no.
I'm a bit miffed about that.
How disappointing.
Yeah.
So here he is. He's now a royal highness. He has a fantastic house. He has an enormous allowance every year. And you said it was challenging to try to figure out what exactly he was doing other than traveling.
Yeah.
When does he resurface in the public record? When were you able to then sort of find out what he does after the travels, after the mourning period and so on and so forth?
Well, you get quite a lot of snide comments in the British press during this period. Basically,
right,
he's got all this money. Why is he travelling?
Because she was really popular, wasn't she?
Charlotte was really popular. He was popular on the back of her,
right,
as it were.
But now he's freeloading off the British public, and he's nothing to do with us.
Yeah,
okay.
Basically. it's this idea of a sort of. But also, the other thing, I think it's just this resurfacing thing of the royals actually being foreign.
I think as well, like, had the child survived,
then
that's another thing. But now I can see how a certain portion of the British public would have been like, well, he's just a parasite now.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
There is a lot of radicalism at the time. You know, this is the period of, this is the man living on 50,000 a year. Then you have the Peterloo Massacre.
Exactly. Yep.
Happening at the same time, you have the Cato Street conspiracy. You have, there's a lot of unpopularity of George IV.
Right.
So Leopold. I mean, we get stories about affairs he has with various society women. I mean, one of them is a sort of adventuress called Jane Digby. I contacted her biographer, and she said no, heard nothing about it. So again. He does actually write to his brother-in-law saying, you know, since Charlotte's died 2 years ago, I really need it. And
How charming.
I mean, well, I mean, he doesn't, I mean, yeah. I put it probably more crudely than he does.
Yeah, but still.
But he's basically still got a sort of young man's libido.
Right.
And again, you're not, I mean, again, there's, I can't find.
Right.
I mean, simply because in those days you didn't.
No.
Talk, I mean, and I suppose you would verbally, I'm sure, but there's not much written.
No, of course not. Yeah, very challenging, I would imagine.
He'd have to be writing letters to someone, wouldn't he, saying, I banged her, now I've banged her, now I've banged her. I just had a look, by the way, and it's the equivalent now of $6 million a year, his allowance.
Woo!
Yeah. So, not bad. Not
plenty,
bad.
Plenty of cash on him.
Yeah, but I think also, I think at the time, there was this, you get it in Byron or like Pushkin, this idea of the sort of, well, early Balzac, the idea of the sort, no, the sort of the shattered aristocrat.
Right. Sort of
the moody, brooding.
Right.
Which we all find great now. We call them romantics for a reason. But yeah. I guess if you are subsisting on peanuts and watching this foreign royal going round on $6 million British pounds a year, you're not going to see them in quite such a romantic light, are you?
Definitely not, no. And also, I think one of the problems is also he was of a personality type, and we all know them. And indeed, apologies to those of you who'll be listening. He was somebody who's quite quiet, but not necessarily shy.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
And I think often, okay, I forgive me if I'm sort of generalizing or being deep, trademark, but often people who are loud and extroverted and bouncy are often quite threatened by the quiet person who's not scared of them.
Yeah.
Right.
But very obviously sitting there taking note. And
well, this is it. It belies the kind of his future as a puppet master, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, often if you're sort of seen to be up to something, then people are always going to be thinking it's sort of like Peter Mandelson effect. You know, he must always be up to something.
Right.
But I think, I mean, but we do have this really, really odd episode in the 1820s about his mistress, Carolina Bauer.
Mm.
A lot of the sort of information we have about Leopold in this period comes from her memoirs, which were published posthumously.
Mm-hmm.
And on the face of it, it is a very, very odd story. Carolina was the niece of Leopold's right-hand man, Stockmar. He was a Coburger. He was trained as a doctor, but basically became his sort of factotum lawyer. He was played by David Suchet many years ago in a drama about Victoria, opposite Jonathan Pryce, who played Leopold. But the story goes, because Carolina was an actress, and Leopold was travelling in Berlin in the late 1820s, and he saw her on stage. And he saw this sort of rather large buxom woman with blonde curls, and he's struck by the resemblance with Charlotte.
Mm.
And from a surviving portrait painting of her in the early night, from sort of about that period, you can definitely see it. So the account goes, he took her back to England with her and gave her Charlotte's dress to wear. I mean, Charlotte's own biographer, Anne Stott, says it's rather like Rebecca.
Mm, definitely.
You see, you know, and then, but the thing is, then it all turns sour. Leopold keeps her in a little cottage, and Charlotte discovers that this unhappy aristocrat isn't somebody as sort of as alluring or as enticing. He's actually just very boring, and all he likes to do is do what was called drizzling, which is feeding in scrap metal, into a machine, which sort of whir away, and then you'd be able to produce metallic objects. Now, for example, he's able to get a sort of recycled sort of metal from epaulettes and make it into a sort of soup tureen for Queen Victoria.
Interesting.
To give it to as a present for her confirmation. No such item exists in the royal collection, I have checked. But, and it's from Charlotte Bauer we get stories about his relationships with people like Jane Digby, understood the rude nicknames of George IV called him. Of course, George IV famously calls Leopold le Marquis de peu à peu, the Marquis of little by little, which again is often quoted. But as far as I can see, that's the earliest source we have for that.
Interesting.
And the problem is, part of me is a bit suspicious about these memoirs, because for one thing, there's too much of the fairy tale,
right,
about them. There's right. too much. Kissing a prince and finding a frog about it. It fits too much in with the sort of libel literature.
Right.
Get. But there's a bit of a but here. One thing that these, if it was done for profit, then Carolina did it very much the wrong way around, because they only published a year after her death.
Right.
In the 1870s, so it was after Leopold's death. And also, I feel that I owe it sort of partly to Charlotte's memory. No, it's a big part. Freudian slip there, Charlotte, I said. Carolina's memory that, because she's somebody from a lower social class, why should I dismiss her out of hand?
Right, right.
And the thing is, when Leopold remarried, his wife Louise wrote to her mother, he does this weird thing called drizzling.
Ah, interesting. Right.
Now, that's not a smoking gun exactly.
No, but it's interesting that it's mentioned by two different.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I mean, I think if Carolina did make it up, then it may have been gossip from within the family, from the Stockmar family.
Right.
Or if she did actually live in England, it'd probably be from the German speaking servants of Clermont. I don't know. So anyway, but it is an odd story. I have found no contemporary evidence that she went to England.
Hmm.
He never mentions her. And I've read a large amount of his private correspondence now.
Hmm.
So it is a mystery. It may stay as a mystery.
Interesting. Now, because there is, at some point, does she claim, or it makes its way into various historical sources, that he actually marries her and therefore
she
is his morganatic wife?
Yes. Yes.
They were married, but no issue.
Yes.
That
yes.
marriage would ever be considered for any sort of a throne.
Yeah.
So that's another little interesting twist to the story, isn't it?
Again, there's no certificate.
Right. No hard evidence at all.
And she says that he would have made her Countess Montgomery.
Right.
Which again, that was the king's prerogative, not his.
Exactly.
Now, of course, if Leopold was utterly cynical, then he could have just told her.
Yeah, tell her that. Whatever you want till she puts
right. it. Yeah, but exactly. Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, part of me thinks, well, would he have been that stupid? I mean, because his brother had also suffered from a sort of libelous pamphlet in the 1820s.
Okay.
And Leopold really tore strip off him.
Interesting.
Now, just because one person's stupid doesn't stop you being stupid.
That is true.
But again, this is a man, he was famed for his caution. And I just don't, I mean, again, we're talking about sex here, so that can affect, especially but not uniquely men.
Right.
Again, it's very much an open question, and I remain agnostic.
Interesting. So at this point, he's been, there is a number of interesting stories about him, number of mysteries about him. How is it that he ends up taking the throne of Belgium?
Right. Well, first of all, he turns down the throne of Greece.
Didn't everyone?
Unstable. Are we sure? Yeah, exactly.
Leopold was he was the trendsetter.
Okay.
He was the proto, he was the he was the first edition refusee of the Greek throne.
Right.
And he regretted it for the rest of his life.
Huh.
Which is, again, this is the romantic thing. He wanted to be in the Greek Isles. The nearest he ever got to Greece was Naples. Mm. But he constantly goes on and on and on about, I wish I'd gone there.
But then seeing the trouble they had with that throne, I mean, it's still my all-time favourite George V diary entry is King Alexander of Greece is dead. He was bitten by a monkey.
I mean, absolutely. Well, even before the arrival of King Otto from Bavaria in 1833, Kapodistrias, who had been Russian foreign minister, then became sort of chief of the provisional government. He was murdered.
But it's like, why would you want a throne in the Balkans? The Balkans is a shit show.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still lobbing monarchs out the window in Serbia in 1903.
Yes. Well, I think Leopold liked the idea of having, of being able to, I mean, he never underestimated his abilities.
Yeah.
And I think compared with what happened with Belgium, where he was basically, basically everything was settled before he arrived.
Right.
He would quite like to have done a bit of the settling.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
He would have liked to have been able to determine what sort of government he would rule, what sort of constitution he would have, what sort of powers he would have.
It's not bad, though, is it, the Belgian? I mean, it's constitutional monarchy, but, I mean, there's command of the armed forces as soon as a war breaks out. There's it's not like they're a puppet, is it?
No, but, I mean, it is a continual complaint of all monarchs, is, oh, why don't I have more power?
Yeah.
Of course.
Because most of you are congenital idiots and inbreed, so that's why. It is your people insuring themselves.
Yeah, but it's also, but also, you know, why? I mean, I think also, again, one of the things about monarchy, you know, unless you abdicate, you know, you do the same job every day.
Yeah, and right. You don't get to quit until you die.
Yeah, and but Leopold had his sort of abdication fantasies throughout his life.
Hmm. Interesting.
And I don't think it's just a political weapon.
Hmm.
I mean, if you children don't behave, I'll abdicate and then you'll be sorry. I don't think.
Oh, well, like Kitchener in the First World War.
Yeah.
yes.
Several times. I got to ask you, because he is ambitious and he's not done with the British throne. And okay, he's not going to sit on it now.
No.
But he does get rampantly involved. Can you just sort out the timeline for me? So, yes, he's Victoria's uncle, and he's going to have a huge influence there, and we'll get to that. But at what point does his sister go in and marry Victoria's mother? Is that after he's kind of his situation has fallen apart with Charlotte, or is it in tandem with it?
Well, that's a very good question. Charlotte, when she marries him, she becomes very excited about being a Coburg.
Right.
She loves the fact, because Leopold's got this big family, big bustling family, they're all writing to each other. They actually get on with each other generally, whereas, of course, Hanoverians hate each other. So Charlotte loves the idea of being a Coburg. And then she thinks, oh, my Uncle Edward, Duke of Kent, why doesn't he marry Leopold's sister?
Okay.
So she does a bit of nagging. Now, I don't know about you, but usually, I think when people start nagging you to marry somebody, one sort of ignores them, really.
It's surely if it's in their better interests, then it's not right for you.
Yeah. Right. But it's sort of, you make such a great couple. And no, my usual answer is no, go to hell. But once Charlotte dies, that's taken away. The baby and her, that's two generations.
Right.
That blows up the whole line of succession, doesn't it?
Yeah, the whole line
so
of
now
succession.
You're on to George, because George IV, like you say, has only managed to stick it in his queen once. It's a disaster once effectively. Absolutely. And now it's kind of blown up with all his siblings. And one of the siblings is Edward, Duke of Kent.
Yes. But so there's a race to the to get married. So you've got Edward and William, Duke of Clarence, future William IV. They get married on the same day. We also get the Duke of Sussex got married morganatically. The Duke of Cumberland, to my shame, I can't remember off the top of my head when he got married. But
all blend into one in the end. But the point is they're all trying to spit a baby out as soon as possible now that there's this gaping hole in the succession.
Cambridge. Yeah, so the Duke of Cambridge gets the first child out, George, future commander-in-chief of the British forces, in April, I think, 1819. Edward and Victoire, Leopold's sister, they managed So they managed to get Victoria born, as it were, in June 1819.
Right.
Because Edward is older than Duke of Cambridge, therefore Victoria's ahead.
Right. Despite being female, and also, she's still ahead.
And also she's born in England.
Ah.
Leopold says it's a great advantage to Victoria.
Definitely.
Now, of course, Leopold's feelings about the birth of his niece are mixed.
Mm.
Of course, he's delighted that his sister's had a baby, but he finds it hard to deal with this fact. And again, it's one thing that, I mean, it's a central fact of Victoria's life, and I do not know, she never consciously acknowledges this, is that Charlotte's death led to Victoria's birth.
Right.
I've asked the biographer Victoria about this, whether she actually knows, whether he's come across anything. He said no, when she must have known, but she never acknowledges the connection.
I've never seen it. I've just seen, I think she was raised as the heir.
Yeah.
She was the heir and it was her place and it didn't matter what had happened before, because it's like, it's all this God's will stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, she does write to Leopold later on, please tell me about Charlotte. And she'll sort of be rather sort of sentimental about the terrible tragedy of Charlotte's death. I mean, Victoria loved death, so that was nice.
Like morbidly, wasn't it? It was like, tell me all about the funeral you went to. What did they do? And what music did they play? It's like, it's creepy.
Yeah, I mean, they loved it. And I think this is partly actually learned behaviour from Leopold. I mean, again, I don't think he would have been the only source of that, but it's curious. So anyway, Leopold is present at Victoria's christening. He writes, says, okay, well, you know, I coped, basically, he says. But this is where things get interesting again. Victoria's father has no money. So he goes to Sidmouth in Devon. And en route, catches a cold, which develops into pneumonia. So, and in 22nd of January 1820, he dies.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
So Leopold's sister is left with a 6-month-old baby.
Right.
But the husband has died by rule standards, straightened circumstances. Leopold writes to Leopold, then goes down to Devon to pick them up. And this channels into a very, very important part of Leopold's persona, the rescuer.
Interesting.
And this is his real bonding moment, I think, with Victoria. And you know, I mean, again, but the rescue thing comes again and again. He rescues Belgium. He's always trying to see, he sees himself as a sort of jack of all trades, master of all. He's always trying to, again and again, he's always boasting about, and again, later on, when Victoria is very much under the influence of Sir John Conroy.
Right.
Leopold again sees himself very much as a rescuer.
Right.
But we get really, I think his relationship, and he does try to sort of, he does help out financially. He does put them up at Claremont. Indeed, Victoria always goes to Claremont on her birthday.
Mm.
What's his relationship like with Conroy, who obviously is the mother's lover and implants himself in and wants all the power? Do they clash?
Yeah. They do clash. To begin with, he finds Victoire, his sister, very needy and is only too happy to have somebody vaguely competent who can sort things out.
Right. Yeah.
But Conroy starts to get ideas about his station.
Mm.
And
he starts claiming he's related to the royal family.
He thinks he's
I forgot about that. Yeah.
I mean, he does. And again, there's a confrontation at Ramsgate in 1835 when Victoria's ill with typhus and Conroy tries to get her to sign thing. Leopold just visited, and I think he probably did put some steel into Victoria. But again, I think Leopold's partly responsible for Victoria's self-image of having an unhappy childhood.
Oh, interesting.
But he refers to Conroy as a sort of Mephisto.
He as well. It's not just him. It's Augusta as well. But there is this whole sort of feeling as she's getting towards 18, isn't there, that she needs to get out of this household, that this is destroying her mental health and she's not safe with him.
Yeah.
And she will be, after all, queen. And so, you know, she should not be subject to such a man.
Yes. Yeah. But I think it's interesting though with Leopold is that he reinforces Victoria's image as a grown up, of her life, which means therefore that he is the sort of king over the water,
as it were.
Now that's actually the wrong expression to use because that suggests trying to supplant her. But he is the sort of king in a mountain,
right?
He's ready.
I mean, he sends Stockmar over, doesn't he? And she needs him. To be fair, she needs someone. She has Melbourne too, but she needs someone to guide her through the early part of her reign.
Well, definitely. He's very careful not to go over himself.
Right, yeah. Right.
Stockmar sent over on about the time of her 18th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And Leopold then butters up Melbourne.
Right.
Because Leopold knows that he can't have the same daily access that Melbourne has.
No.
But he knows that prime ministers come and go.
Absolutely.
And he's known Melbourne since 1814. Mm-hmm. So Melbourne gets sort of love bombed.
Right.
As happens to most British statesmen.
Right. Right.
During Leopold's life. So you go. Yeah.
Very, very clever, Leopold, guide and maintain some semblance of power without overstepping and making his niece feel like he's taking things on himself that he shouldn't be because she's queen. And also because he is at this point, he is technically still a foreigner. Yeah. And so it's rather subtle of him.
Yeah.
Now, how does it, is it Leopold who you think is directly responsible for Albert?
Directly, but not originally.
Right. Okay. Tell us more about that.
Okay. Albert was a few months younger than Victoria.
Right.
When he was born on the 26th of August, 1819, and Rosenau, which is the sort of schloss outside Coburg, and his grandmother, who was Leopold, and obviously Leopold and Victoire's mother,
mm-hmm.
a woman called Auguste, sort of clapped her lips of glee and said, "Oh, right." And she says almost in her diary straight away, "Oh, right. And then he can marry the little girl in England, can't he?"
That's very funny. Yeah.
Those of us who come across domineering grandmothers know that it can be, rather difficult to gainsay. Now, she dies in 1831,
mm-hmm.
but it's very much predetermined.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
To that degree, I think, obviously, there never was a sort of Coburg plan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think, please forgive me for using this expression, dynasticism was in their DNA.
Yeah. Right.
It's just what they did.
Right.
And I think the ideas of consanguinity weren't particularly well developed at that stage.
Right. He doesn't just stop there either, does he? There's more matchmaking.
No. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Well, I mean, my argument is actually the greatest match he made was with his second wife, Louise.
Tell us about that.
Well, he's become King of the Belgians.
Right.
In 1831, after the Belgian Revolution of 1830. Mm-hmm. And the best way for him to guarantee stability in that region was for him to marry the daughter of the King of the French, Louis-Philippe.
Ah, right.
Because, again, Belgium was neutral, as we all know.
Exactly.
But I think there's this temptation to think, oh, well, Germany must be the threat to Belgium because of 1914.
Hmm.
No, most people who weren't French were worried about France invading Belgium.
Of course.
But there's a Napoleonic precedent.
Yes.
There as well. And a good way of sort of soft power way of preventing this was for Leopold to marry Louise.
Right.
It was also, I mean, it helped that he was also an old friend of the king.
Mm-hmm.
They've both been living in England at the same time.
Right.
Quite similar personalities. But so Louise is basically sort of sacrifices herself for Leopold. There's some quite, she grows to love him.
Mm.
And he grows to love her. But it's obviously not the same fire and passion that you get with him and Charlotte.
Mm.
I think Leopold and Charlotte were sexually compatible.
Mm.
I rather think, whereas Louise is very, very different, sort of very, very differently made, very, very different sort of nature. And she writes to her mother, she keeps on trying to hug me. it's like, you know, he says nice things, but it's painful because this is a woman who is over 20 years younger than him.
Right. And he's 41, which at
he's 41. Point, it doesn't, I mean, this happened a lot at the time, but it's still,
yes,
it's painful.
Yeah. She finds it uncomfortable and it's really too old for her.
No, she's not a sexual being.
Yeah. Certainly not with Leopold. Yeah.
No. And no, they managed three children.
Mm, right.
But I can come on to that later, perhaps. But yes, so thing is, the Orleans dynasty had come, of which Louise was a member, came to the throne in France in 1830 through a revolution.
Right, of course.
And they are in search of legitimacy.
Absolutely, yeah.
So Leopold becomes a sort of marriage agent. So it's he who tries to negotiate with the Habsburgs to marry Louis-Philippe's son, Ferdinand. It doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But two of his, he has one nephew and one niece, both marry, of his, Coburgs, marry into the Orleans family.
Mm.
And so that's Clémentine, who is Louise's sister, marries Leopold's nephew. Are you keeping up?
we might need a chart later on, but so far, so good. Yes.
And, marries August. And they eventually produce the kings of Bavaria, of Bulgaria, Foxy Ferdinand.
Right.
Is a product of that marriage. You also get the Duc de Nemours married Victoire, who was Leopold's niece.
Mm-hmm.
A very sort of, quite a sort of sexy woman whom Leopold fancies. A bit cringe. Again,
very cringe.
Yeah, because he writes a letter about it to Nemours' brother, saying Nemours a bit of a virgin, isn't he?
Mm.
You know, he's got this sex bomb. I mean, this is her uncle writing about it. It's like, so he's very much involved with creating this sort of dynastic network.
Interesting.
With usually sort of liberal German Protestant families with the Orleans dynasty. He's also, I mean, he much, much later on, he's involved where he doesn't necessarily arrange the marriage of Victoria's son Bertie, but of course it's not surprising that the engagement happens at the Palace of Laeken outside Brussels.
Yeah.
So he writes, he's very, very detailed instructions about who needs to stay where and who goes where. So he's very much a sort of stage manager
Interesting.
Director for that. He's always sort of, I mean, obviously you get these various, he also arranges for his nephew Ferdinand to marry the Queen of Portugal.
Right, right.
Fat Marie, as he chivalrously calls her. And again, but that was actually, what's interesting about that, it was a dynastic marriage very much arranged on the hop. But he more says, Ferdinand, I love you, go to Portugal, marry her. Is that...
Wow,
It's nothing like the sort of slowly catchy monkey preparation that Albert and Victoria have.
Interesting. So his impact, because of course by the time the Victoria's son, the Prince of Wales, I guess, by the time he gets married, Leopold is getting on.
Yes.
And I know he lives to about 1865.
Yes.
So what happens with all of this matchmaking and so on?
Yeah.
What are the last few years of his life like? Is he happy? Is he,
He's sad, old man. I think it's also his last great match, of course, is evil Leopold marries Marie-Henriette.
Ah, yes.
And his daughter Charlotte marries Maximilian, the Emperor, who becomes Emperor of Mexico.
Right, and that doesn't go well.
What about Stephanie?
Stephanie's the daughter of...
The poor one that's rendered infertile after one kid by that idiot heir of Franz Joseph, who then goes and kills himself.
Yeah. That's off.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but that marriage happened after Leopold's death.
Ah, okay.
It's quite a long way in advance, but it's a sort of legacy of Leopold's matchmaking. I mean, the idea that the Coburgs are married to the Habsburgs does show how far they've established themselves by the 1850s.
Yeah.
1830s, that would not have been...
Right, not possible at all.
Yeah. So it really shows, I think, the impact of 1848.
Right.
Which Belgium shows itself to be very sort of stable.
Yes, that's right.
The other dynasties. So at the end of the last years of his life are quite melancholy. He becomes very, very, and I think ultimately he is an introvert. He becomes very isolated. He prefers not to be seen. He suffers from 1859 onwards with very painful bladder stones.
Oh, yeah.
That's a pleonasm. They are very painful. But, I mean, to the extent that he gets treated by a French doctor, Civial, who invented a lithotrite.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Into urethra. Urethra. And that by that means you'd be crushing.
Right. Yeah.
Stones. Again, without anaesthetic.
Yeah. Which is, exactly. Excruciatingly painful.
Excruciatingly painful. And then, I mean, such is his pain that he can't sleep. Lying down, he has to be sort of wedged between two mattresses, standing up. So it's a sort of bedtime crucifixion. And he basically sorted out by a chap called Thompson, who manages to crush most of them. You can actually, if you go to the Wellcome Collection in London, you can see the crushed kidney stone, bladder stone.
Love the Wellcome and what they hang on.
We're going to do that in the summer.
Yeah, it's right next to Napoleon III's bladder stone, which is like a sort of golf ball and uncrushed.
Wow.
But Thompson, the interesting thing is there's a legacy of this, because Thompson made an accidental discovery because he used an instrument which hadn't been used before. And Leopold didn't suffer from fever afterwards.
Ah.
Thompson put two and two together and thought, oh, there weren't any germs on it. So this is about the same time.
I was going to say, that's roughly about the time that Lister. Yeah,
absolutely. So, Thompson, in his own way, comes to sort of same conclusion at the same time.
Interesting. Yeah.
But he's sort of, I think also, but he's very, very, he spends a lot of time on his own. I mean, one quite comic thing that was recorded is that he visited Victoria towards the end.
Yes.
And he was supposed to be on her, and of course, Victoria's busting in to come and talk to him. Yeah. And she's the only person that was a fellow sovereign who had the sort of right to do that. And because he'd become a bit of a sort of famous five Uncle Quentin by that stage. And he just couldn't, but he had to put up with Victoria being sort of, Victoria making sort of social demands on him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, Albert, at this point, Albert has been gone and she has fully embraced.
Albert's gone, yeah. I mean,
embraced her widowhood. And
her bereavement is the most important bereavement ever in the whole history of humanity.
Yes.
You say that, but she's more sad when Disraeli dies. She actually says that's the worst one ever. And I'm like, actions would suggest.
Yeah. I think there's probably a bit of sort of bereavement inflation.
Yeah, a bit of drama queening going on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she was. The thing is also, I mean, Leopold himself, though, I mean, there are certain habits which lingered on. For example, in Claremont, Charlotte's coat was kept in the same place.
Oh, that's interesting.
I hope that Victoria was having rampant sex with Disraeli, with John Brown, with the Indian servant. Fuck it. She's a widow at 41. She wasn't dead.
No.
She had sex. She had 9 kids. She loved sex. I hope she had them all. In the most filthy way imaginable.
Yeah. Well, she probably didn't discuss that with Leopold, though. But
Doubtful.
Anymore. I mean, I think this, Victoria's a prude, I think, is an idea which is, I hope, has been blown out of the water.
Yeah, I tried with my biography in that book last year.
Yeah, it's just, she was no, there's no way in which.
I'd like her, I don't know if you would have even called him an obstetrician, but the doctor looking after her when she was pregnant the first time was just like, stop talking to me. I don't want to know all the details, woman. It's uncouth.
Yeah. I think with Leopold's worry about sex was VD.
Of course. Well, because.
His nephew Ernest, right. But there was certainly, it's VD and scandal.
Absolutely.
So, yes. And so it's quite funny the way he talks about it. He's discussing with Victoria, Ernest got involved in certain activity. It's always, I think the euphemisms always make it funnier anyway. But
they do, definitely.
This need to control behavior. No, with Albert. Kate Williams thinks that Stockmar got Albert initiated in Italy. Again, we don't know. I mean, it's just him writing to Albert and saying, if you go to Italy, you'll be made a man. We just don't. Again, it's not the sort of thing you'd sort of write, dear diary.
You do if you're the Duke of Windsor. You complain that the prostitutes were ugly and no one could get a boner on your first brothel visit in Paris.
Yes, he was.
Let's not talk about
charming. Him. Charming. Yeah, he was. I see. But I think But the thing is, also Louise though stops having conjugal relations really after about 1840.
Okay.
She had a difficult birth with their Charlotte.
Right.
And Leopold takes a fancy to a lady called Arcadie.
Right.
And she's very quickly married off to Herr Meyer, who is the man in charge of the stables. I can't remember the word actually. Forgive me. Stable master, whatever the word.
Right.
He's very quickly, and Leopold persuades his nephew Ernest to give Maya as a Coburg barony.
Right, to sort of provide cover for this.
Yeah, but I mean, the coat of arms is quite interesting because it's half, it's half a lion and half a St. George's cross, but as in the Greek.
Oh, that's interesting.
As in the Greek flag.
Let it go, Leopold. Let it go. You turned it down.
He wants to hang on to it. Yeah, that's very funny.
He can't, they've got a descendant. So they both the von Eppinghovens. They then had children, etc., etc. And there's a Belgian genealogist who's traced them all over the world to
Right, right. So they do, in fact. So one would hope that that brought him some happiness.
Yes.
You know, because as you said earlier, he does seem to have been someone who enjoyed women.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of various women pop up at different points. You know.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And I mean, obviously, paintings always exaggerate and they make you look much much better than you are. But yeah. I was interested to see that a number of paintings of him that, you know, even if you take into account the fact that they might be covering up a myriad of flaws, is that he's not half bad looking. You know.
No.
He's pretty, you know, he seems relatively attractive.
Yes.
And you know, as you were saying, you know, he apparently has some sort of a gift with the ladies.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would imagine that late in life like that.
Yes. Well, I think also, yeah, himself. I mean, so I'm interrupting you, forgive me.
No, 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 go ahead. You're the guest.
I think certainly he's a young man. He was, you know, face of standard, good looks,
right.
Strong bone structure.
Right.
I mean, there's some of the photographs, the sort of daguerreotypes of him in the 1850s and 60s.
Right.
It's devastating. It's a sort of, it's rather like Graham Southern's Portrait of Churchill.
I mean, yes.
As Simon Sharma said, it's a magnificent wreck.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And I think also, you know, he was. I mean, I think as a lover, he wasn't a sort of into braggadocio. He wasn't machismo.
Yes.
It's sort of attention to little details.
Mm.
I'll give you one example, though it's about Victoria.
Right.
But I think this is very much sort of him at the sort of softer side. She was once staying in Belgium, I think, or he brought some biscuits over. She said, I like these biscuits.
Mm.
So every month, the British Embassy in Brussels has given some biscuits to send over in a diplomatic bag.
Yeah. So
Victoria.
Yeah.
So he sort of dotes.
Right, the attention to detail, yeah. The sort of remembering, yeah, of the small touches,
yes,
that were important.
Yes, very much so. Yes.
So I did see an image of the rather astonishing, funeral procession for him. So he does, yes, he does ultimately die in 1865. At which point he's lived to a fairly venerable old age, because,
yes,
that would have, yes, been 75.
75, yes.
So when he dies, what is the reaction of the Belgians? What's the reaction of, you know, he's been king at that point for, you know, for quite some time.
Yeah.
Are they bereaved? Are they indifferent? Other than, you know, the appalling, we won't speak about,
yeah,
Leopold II, but other, yeah, than that, what was the reaction?
The reaction, well, I think, again, I think he's very much respected.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than loved.
Mm.
I think he has become a bit of a sort of, become a fixture.
Right.
And I think the other thing is also, and this was that he did say that, you know, without Belgium, no, without me, Belgium couldn't exist.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I mean, one Belgian historian, Elsevier, said that, well, that shows really what a fatuous old fool he was. And, and, you know, I think, yes, I'm going to be very annoying here, and I'll say yes, yeah, and no. Yes, he is being fatuous.
Yeah.
He was, mm-hmm, no, he was being a sort of humble, not even humble bragging. No, he was bragging about his,
right,
importance. But, yes, the thing is, without the crown, without the monarchy, Belgium would not have been allowed to, Belgium in the 1830s could not have been a republic.
Right.
Well, not only that, but just going on to the next...
Yeah.
Of 80 years of Belgian history, they have one,
yes,
of the most sparkling economies in the world.
Yes,
the country itself before World War One was,
yes,
doing damn well.
Yes, I mean, also, I mean, a lot of, obviously, you know, the Congo was one, no, money from the rubber industry from the 1890s onwards is one reason, but Belgium is an industrial powerhouse from the 1830s onwards.
Their, no, industry,
yeah,
was on the eve of World War One.
Yeah,
they are making more money than America because of,
yeah,
the American Civil War,
yeah,
beating the American economy,
yeah,
down. They're like,
yeah,
it's the railways, isn't it? It's producing,
yeah,
the rolling stock. They have the most,
yes,
dense network of railway lines on the planet. It's all railway.
Yeah. I mean, Leopold himself was there when the first railway is opened between Brussels and Mechelen,
mm,
on the 5th of May, 1835. A lovely locomotive called L'Elephant, the elephant, which you can now see at the Schabeck. the Railway World Museum. It's a wonderful place. So, I mean, he loves railways because he's a traveller.
Right, of course.
And again, he's one of the very few. These days, you know, we can just pop on Ryanair, EasyJet or whatever, or wait 50 hours in Eurostar. But he was one of the few people at the time who did travel so much.
Right, right.
And the British minister, who didn't have an ambassador in his time, made a joke, which I would like to make the title of my book. But he said, well, Leopold's throne rests on casters.
Ah, right. Yeah,
I would like to use that as a title, but casters is a bit slightly obscure word. But he's always going to England. He's always going to Paris, especially before 1848. He's always going to watering places like Wiesbaden.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or later on, North Italy. So he's always gadding about.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Any thoughts on Leopold you want to leave our listeners with before we end?
All I can say is I think this is a fascinating life, not also simply because of the sort of the events he lived through, but also I think it's very, he's one of the few people, he's somebody who leaves a huge amount on paper of insight, not always intentional.
Right.
And he's something so very much, I mean, we do get a real insight into the day-to-day running, day-to-day life of a head of state. Also, of course, his correspondence with Victoria is about something like 1,000 to 2,000 letters.
Yeah.
And you just don't really, well, I can't think of any correspondence with two heads of state, possibly between the sort of kings of Norway and Denmark. Mm. But I've got no idea what the correspondence looks like, life's too short. But no, so we know an all, there's a heck of a lot to know about him. And I think also the 19th century was the first century really in which you get long careers.
Yes.
Had them beforehand, but really this is the period of Metternich, Wellington, Mr. Gladstone, and I think Leopold's among them. And it's that longevity which makes it so interesting.
Great. Thank you. So I'd like to say thank you today to our guest, Christopher Greiber, whose new book on Leopold I. Do you have a timeline, Christopher, at this point? An idea when we might get to actually read it?
I would love to be able to say. Unfortunately, I do a full-time job, so it's very much the remains of the day.
I have both Alex and I have great sympathy for that. We will perhaps check back with you further on.
Yes, okay.
When you get closer to publication date, see how it's going. I'm sure that our listeners at History Hack would love to read it. And thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating discussion about Leopold. We've greatly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.